Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm fine.
Good.
Okay.
Hey, Joe.
Hi. Hi, Joe. Welcome, everybody, to Applause Radio Show. I'm Joanne Barton, and on the other line is Mr.
It's John Arricchio. How's everybody out there?
We're great, right? Right? I'm doing all right, other than not knowing what day it is anymore. I'm so confused. But we have a great show for you guys tonight. Oh, my God. We have Mr. Joe Alves. He is the production designer of the movie Jaws and so many others, and I cannot believe he did one of my favorite movies that of all time. Well, not of all time, but of Elvis movie, one of my favorite Elvis movies.
Oh,
and, yeah, bro,
change of habit.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk to you about that one. I mean, also all the other ones. And also we have the phenomenal singer. Her name is Shirley King. She is the daughter of blues legend B.B. King, and she is releasing a new album on the 19th. And guess what? She came to us to let us play her first releases. How cool is that, Johnny Boy?
That's really cool.
You know, so anyway, let's get started with Joe. He's been holding. Let's get going here. So before we start, thank you to our sponsors, the High Bar and Bistro in Garfield, New Jersey, Precious Memory Video, Kidnersville, Pennsylvania, KWV Wines in South Africa, Tees for the Times in Clifton, New Jersey, Syntech Productions in Lenoka Harbor, and Oleander PR in Texas. And thank you so much for joining us now, a new member of our family. Take a break from cancer.org for Pete's sake. They are a wonderful organization. Check out their website. If there's anything you can do to help out, you have no idea what you'd be doing to help those folks out. We'll talk about it later. So on the phone, Mr. Alves, how are you, sir?
I'm good. It's very nice here in California.
Yeah, I bet. Well, it's getting nicer out this way. It's trying anyway. I don't know about by Johnny Boy, but by me, it's, you know, iffy today, but nice. So, sir, we have to apologize first and foremost for running long on time when you were originally supposed to be with us last month. I am so very sorry for that. I do apologize. So, Joe.
Well, yes.
Let's talk. So, I got to ask, well, first of all, I'm mad at you. I mentioned it in my post. I have not been able to go into the ocean since freaking Jaws, okay? So I'm mad about, well, I'm not a big ocean person anyway, but I'm definitely afraid to go in the freaking water.
Yeah.
If I can't see my feet, I'm not going in. So tell us how that all, I mean, was Jaws wasn't your first film, was it, or?
No, actually, with Steven, it was my second film. Sugarland Express was the first one. And then, of course, I worked in the business 20 years before that. I was an animator, assistant animator at Walt Disney on tour, Forbidden Planet. I did The Id, and then I was assistant art director with Alfred Hitchcock on Torn Curtain. And then I did a number of television movies, and I did a television series called Night Gallery, and that's
great
where
show.
I met Steven. And then from then it was Sugarland and Jaws and Close Encounters. Let me just say something about Jaws and the fear of water, because there was something on on 60 Minutes last night was a repeat. But anyway, it was about how Jaws did such a terrible thing for the white shark. And, you know, Peter Benchley really was very, very sorry about that. He spent the rest of his life trying to undo that because people were out there killing sharks for no reason. But that was not the reason, you know, to make people afraid of sharks. It was just the shark was the enemy.
Oh, of course. It was just a movie, but, you know, it's something we do all the time. And, you know, honestly, when you do, even before the movie, you were always afraid that something was going to get you, whether it was a fish brushed up against you or something. But
yeah.
Jaws just brought it all to the forefront and said, yep, that's exactly what's going to happen to you if it happens to you. So it woke everybody's ass up saying, That's it. You're done, you know.
Yeah, and it's just amazing. Now with the 45th anniversary of of Jaws, that the interest, you know, Universal's got a new 4K DVD out, and I have a book out, Designing Jaws. And so it's just a lot of activity after all these years. I'm sort of surprised, frankly. Mm.
And how big was the actual shark in the movie? Was it really a great white? I mean, replica, everything to the exact? I mean, I'm not a fish expert, so I don't know. I mean,
well,
you know,
I'm trying to sell my book, but in my book, Joelle's Design Shark, it explains that I did concept sketches basically on the book before Steven was on the movie. It was before they even had any charge numbers, or the studio wasn't even interested. It was just David Brown's wife, Helen Gurley Brown, who is the editor of Cosmopolitan, said, you know, I just read these gala sheets of this book called Jaws. I think it might make a pretty good movie. And having worked with David on Sugarland, and I was a staff art director. At those times, you had studios that have all... it was quite different, but you know, you were a staff guy and you did whatever movie they told you. Anyway, I did a whole bunch of illustrations to sell the idea to the studio to do this movie. And once it was approved, then I worked with an ichthyologist from the Steinhardt Oceanographical Studies, San Francisco. And I did a 4-foot clay shark, and he worked with me to get it absolutely exact. I mean, there was no question. We made that shark look as real as we could possibly.
Yeah. What was it made of? What was it?
First of all, we had to make a mold, and so we did that with wood and clay and stuff. And then it had a chromoly tube frame. And then there was elastomer and various plastics. In other words, what happened was we had a big meeting about making this movie after I did all those sketches. And Steven came aboard, and there was a meeting with all the department heads. And Marshall Green was the head of production then. And so they all looked – the head of the art department, the camera, editing, and special effects. And so after I finished my spiel about the shark does this and that, and I had talked with Steven, even though he hadn't been on a movie yet, and we said, if we make this, you know, we want to do like a big shark in a real ocean, not in a studio pond with a phony backdrop. So what happened as I started to study it, first of all, when Marshall asked the effects department, could they make this, and they said, no, it'll take a year and a half to make a shark like that, and it's never been done. It's never been put in the ocean. And besides, we have bigger movies like the Hindenburg and blah, 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 and Marshall got very upset and said, Jaws could be a bigger movie than the Hindenburg. And everybody laughed because the Hindenburg was going to be their big movie. Basically, as everybody left,
that was a great movie, too. Yeah, that was a great movie.
Oh, yeah, I loved it. Anyway, as I was walking out, Marshall said, "Can you get the shark made?" And being young and ambitious, I said, sure. So I put together, I found Bob Matty, who had been at Disney's, did the giant squid in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And then we had to find specialists. So now you're asking about what it was made of. Roy Abergass was making breakaway bottles at the studio, and he was a specialist in all the new plastics. Mm-hmm. And we had to have styrofoam, you know, that wouldn't absorb water. We had to have elastomer, a different kind of. We had to paint it with a number 40 silica sand so it wouldn't beat off like a balloon, you know. So a lot of studies were made. Now, the ichthyologist told me that white sharks are perfect shape at 12 feet. Excuse me. But as they get bigger, they get girthier, they get fatter. So Steve and I thought, well, we'll take a 12-foot shark and we'll double that. And so we made it in about 25 feet. That was the size.
Wow.
Excuse me, I got some sneeze. Anyway.
Bless you. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay.
How did you get him to move? I mean, was it remote controlled, or was someone inside operating it?
Oh, no. We had pneumatic lines.
Mm.
So we had three sharks. We had sharks that we would tow from 300 feet away. We would drag them, and they had all these wires and hoses and stuff. So we had a left to right and a right to left so that the backside was open so we could get to the mechanics. And then we had one on a giant platform that would sink, and it had a track with a big arm, crane arm. It would come up, so that one we could hit the boat with. Now, it was pneumatics, valves and rams and electronics. So it was all operated from a barge some, you know, few yards away, so you wouldn't see it. And it was controlled electronically.
Wow.
Very, very complicated. Extremely complicated.
How long did it take to make one of them?
Well, we were making three at the same time. But here's the problem. We were supposed to have a year and a half to make them.
Wow.
And when I had that meeting, it was October. And by the time they okayed, you know, making the shark and all that, and I put a team together, it was probably November of 1973. And the book came out, the Jaws book came out in February of 74. And the studio said, we're going to start shooting in 2 months.
Right.
Well, where's my year and a half? That was
like
4 months.
Right.
So the guys worked day and night, and Stephen got them to delay it to the 1st of May. And, it, of course, it's very cold in Martha's Vineyard. And so they weren't ready yet. You know, we were testing, but the salt water would eat the electronics, and no one's ever done it. No one's ever had a big animatronic thing in the real ocean.
It looked real, you know. I mean,
yeah, and it really worked once it got working. Yeah. So Steven had to shoot everything, every walk and talk, before we could use the shark. So we shot everything without the shark, and then we would test it. I would go to Bob Matty, and I would say, what shark do you have working? And he says, I think the left to right works. And I would go to Steven, and I said, the left to right might be working. If it works, shoot it. If it doesn't, it's a test. But in the meantime, I did some, like, 200 storyboards of every shot with the shark and on the boat, once the guys left on the boat, so we could, you know, everybody could refer to, we're shooting this shot tomorrow, the shot comes by the boat, you know.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, all those storyboards are in my book. They're sort of interesting because it shows you shot for shot. Now, I planned all the shots with Steven, and we sat down while we were shooting other stuff and planned shot for shot. So there was no surprises. Tomorrow we're going to shoot the platform shark hitting the stern of the boat. And so everybody would prepare for that. It would take a day in advance to get everything ready for the next day.
Right. Cool.
So
wow.
It was incredibly difficult. And, of
right.
course, not only you're dealing with ocean, water, you're dealing with the weather and the waves, and then there was another big problem.
Mm-hmm.
The big problem was Stephen wanted them totally isolated, so they were out by themselves. It was just the three guys, you know, crusty old fisherman, smart ichthyologist kid, and then the policeman who didn't want to be on
right.
the boat at all. But he wanted absolutely, they were out there by themselves. Now, what happened was, I scouted all over New England. I met Peter Benchley in New York, and I said, where did you write this for? And he said, he's from New England. So he says, you know, Sag Harbor, Stonington, various places, Montauk, but nothing specific. So I had a map, and I was also looking for some water because of the platform shark. I needed 25 feet of depth so that it would be, you know, sit on the bottom, a flat bottom, and I needed a very small tide. And the tides on the West Coast were like 12, 14 feet.
Mm.
So anyway, so when I was looking for the little village, I was also looking for a place to shoot the shark.
Right, right.
And so I went all over New England and Long Island and down to Woods Hole in Massachusetts. And Peter said to go to Nantucket and see his parents. They live in Nantucket and could check that. I said, what about this other island, Martha's Vineyard? And he said, I don't think there's anything there, but he'd never been there. So anyway, long story short, is I got down to Woods Hole, and I'm in the winter, so every beach I'm looking at has snow on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I start to go to Nantucket, and the weather is so rough, the boat turns around and says, we can't make it all the way there. And I see a boat to Martha's Vineyard, which is much closer. So I go there, and it's incredible. You know, Edgartown is beautiful, and Menemcha is a fishing village, and right there is this bay, and it's 25 feet depth and 2 foot tide. So it was like perfect, except that was in the winter.
I was going to ask you, when was it filmed to not have a crowd, only actors all around? I mean, what type of what season was it?
Well, we started shooting terrible. We started shooting in May. And it was great for Martha's Vineyard because the crowd hadn't come yet, but it was really freezing cold. So we shot all the ocean stuff. But now when we started shooting the shark in July, August, there are just hundreds of boats coming from, you know,
everywhere.
You know, from everywhere. And Stephen, pardon?
It's the summer season. That's what they do, you know.
Yeah, and but in the winter there was nothing, and so he didn't want any boats in there, so that was very difficult.
Well, that's why I thought maybe it was done in the colder weather, you know, to avoid the crowd that goes every summer, and you know, must have been difficult filming in that freezing weather with the ocean scene.
Yeah, well, no, they wanted us to continue shooting because they wanted to release it. The point is, the reason we started shooting so early is because they wanted to take advantage of the popularity of the book, so they wanted to make it a summer release.
Yeah.
And so we continued to shoot, you know, and then eventually we were over schedule. Eventually then we got more towards, you know, let's see, August, or so there weren't so many boats and we could steer them away. So it was really very, very difficult because we were over schedule, you know, over budget.
Yeah. Well, correct me if I'm wrong. I heard this story my whole life, and it's just escaping me right now. It was based on a true story in Jersey, no?
You mean his book?
Yeah.
I really can't answer that because we, you know, once Peter, so he wrote the first script, and then Stephen got Carl Gottlieb, and we made a much more linear story, so there wasn't, because the book had the mafia in it, and they had the police chief. It was so different in some ways. It had the police chief's wife having an affair with the Dreyfus character. It had all this corruption in the island. And so we just sort of streamed that away and just made it a shark's out there and the...
The story, the shark is the story. That's it.
Yeah, and the mayor is saying, you know, everybody goes swimming, everything's fine. And the police chief said, no, we had a dead body. We found, you know, the girl that was eaten in the beginning. So there was a fight between the chief of police not wanting to put anybody in water and the mayor wanting to have everything wonderful like it was. Like today we have a, you know,
epidemic, of course.
It's the same thing. Everybody, oh, it's fine, go out and play. And it's like, go in the water. Nobody's, until then, the little Kittner kid went, and then he got it. So it was, anyway.
Yep. Isn't that funny how life imitates art, right? So.
Hey, Joanne, we have a caller on the line for Joe. If Joe wants to ask, answer a question, we have Regina on the line. Go ahead. Regina?
Oh, can you hear me? Hello?
Yes.
Hi, Joanne. Hi, everybody. How are you?
Hi.
So
Wait a minute. Guess who this is, John? This is Regina Grace.
Who's
she was the production designer on, Regina, refresh my memory on what
no,
you do.
No, I wasn't a production designer. I'm a set decorator.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm so glad that I think I'm calling in a little bit late. So, Joe, I'm a fan of yours. One of the first films I ever saw in the movie theater, believe it or not, was Jaws. I'm not sure if that, like, jumpstart my wanting to be in the film business and be a decorator or anything like that. But if you answered this question already, because I tuned in a little bit late, forgive me. But I have a couple questions, actually.
Sure, go ahead.
That movie to me seemed like a huge production, and I caught where you were saying, like, I think that you had to build, like, three sharks?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or have them fabricated. Back in the 70s, I mean, what kind of, like, time frame and budget did you have? Because nowadays, I mean, everything is, you know, they just want to speed through everything, you know.
Oh, yeah, and
it's
CGI.
Kind of set time.
Yeah, they would make a full shark. Anyway, but before a decorator, I had a great decorator on. John Dwyer was wonderful, and we had worked together on Night Gallery, and he was great. Did a great job. Anyway, yeah, we built three sharks, as I explained, and because we needed two of them would be towed from 300 feet, and the other would be on a platform, and we could regulate. And they were, 25 feet. So let's see, what was the question again?
So I wanted to say, like, the time frame, from the prep until you started shooting. Like, how long did you have to build the sharks themselves?
All right.
Kind of budget did you have? Was it like an unlimited budget or?
Yeah, no. You missed that part. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Dale. Sorry.
Well, I'll just say this. We started on November of 73, and everybody all the effects people, the professionals at Disney and Joe Lombardi, who did all the Godfathers and their studio, they said it would take a year and a half to make the sharks and test them because it's never been done. When the book came out in February, a couple months after we started, they said they want to start shooting in 2 months. So we didn't have a year and a half. We had like 4 or 5 months, and they want us to start shooting the shark. And so the basic thing was we were testing and shooting. If it worked, you know, we shot it. If it wasn't, it was a test. And we had the budget. We had no budget because how do you budget something like that? But let me just say this. We built three sharks, and we built it away from the studio. We got it away from the studio system. Everything was always done in-house in the studio. But the head of production told me to do it independently and go off and get a group of people and start making it. Well, so I made it whatever it cost. The interesting thing is the three sharks back then cost a total of $250,000. Now, when we did Jaws 2, I was working on Close Encounters, and I got back to the studio, and they already started building the sharks for Jaws 2 in the studio. They had already spent $2 million. So the thing is, when they do it in the studio, then they start charging. Oh, that was a successful movie. They just start putting charges on Jaws 2 like crazy. And so it cost a lot more, and I had more studio influence. Where the first Jaws, I had almost nobody. The studio didn't even want to make that movie. You know, they'd come out.
And Jaws, and the first one was definitely better than the second.
Well, you know, sequels are sequels. The three I worked on made a lot of money. You know.
Yeah.
I mean.
What was the budget to actually build the shark? They cost $250 each, but what was the budget?
No. $250,000 for the whole.
For all of them.
All of them.
Saying basically there was no budget, because how do you budget something like that?
You can't budget something you've never done.
Yeah.
The whole budget was scheduled at $4.5 million, and I think we went way over budget at $7.5 million, and they were screaming at us. We were not heroes. We were just not thought of, and there was just going to be this lousy movie, and then they had a sneak preview, and everybody screamed and flipped out in the studio. Said, oh, my God, I guess this is pretty good. So they did something they've never done before, is they had a big release in the summer, and they never had big releases in the summer. That was the very first one that had, it was at 450 theaters, and it was a lot. And so it started the summer blockbusters. It was the very first one.
And
they didn't have any idea, they really didn't, that it would be so successful.
Yeah,
we were not heroes at all when we got back. We were in sad shape, and then it came out, and then of course, once it came out, and in Hollywood, once you have a big success, well, then your next one is easier to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I know we're focusing on Jaws because it's the anniversary and because of the book, but Joe has done also. Close Encounters, as he mentioned, Starman, oh my God, Drop Zone, and he's done, Joe, you know we got to talk about
and lots
Escape
of TV before. Shows. And,
yeah.
I think Escape from New York has a real fan base, and that was sort of fun because that was John Carpenter, and they had made really low budget films like Halloween and stuff like that, and so when I got with them, we sort of expanded it a little bit. That was a lot of fun to make that movie.
Yeah. What was your other
some really great projects.
Pardon?
No, I was just going to say he worked on some really great projects, and I was going to ask him because, you know, he had such a long,
of course,
history
I did
of working.
Three...
What was your favorite?
Oh.
Do you have a favorite?
No, I don't, you know, I mean.
Or most proud of.
You know, Jaws is the most popular. Jaws 2 was extremely difficult. I was a second unit director. They fired the first director. I brought in a new director. I did 85 days directing second unit. I was the designer. And then on Jaws 3, I directed that in 3D. That was very difficult with the 3D and all the convergence and all that. The fun was Escape from New York because I just liked the group, and it was a different thing. Close Encounters was extremely... difficult in that it was one of the biggest sets ever built, I was Stephen did a thing, a presentation for me, because the art directors gave me an award this year in February, a Lifetime Achievement Award, Greg Nicotero introduced me, and they had all these cuts of movies I worked on. And then Steven shows up on film, and he talks about our relationship, how good it was. And he said, Close Encounters, he says, I still never worked on this any set as big as the one we did on Close Encounters, you know.
Where was Close Encounters filmed?
We shot that in Mobile, Alabama, and I'll tell you why. I don't know how much time we have, but when...
You have plenty. You got the whole night, honey. It's all yours.
Okay, well, just briefly this. When Stephen came to me about Close Encounters, we went skiing while he was editing Jaws, and he was going to do this picture called Bingo Long, and it's Traveling All-Stars. So I had done a lot of research. I brought some Life magazines. It was the 30s, black baseball. And he started talking about this Dr. Alan Hynek's book, UFO, A Scientific Inquiry. And there's different chapters, Close Encounters of the First Kind, Second Kind, and Third Kind. And so I said, gee, Stephen, he says, I'm working on a script. I said, that sounds like a more interesting project than the Black Baseball. He said, yeah, but we don't have a deal. So a few weeks later, I got a call from John Badham, who's a director I worked with quite a bit on Night Gallery, and John said he was doing Bingo Long. In the meantime, Ralph Nelson was director, and a friend of mine said, you should work with Ralph, and he is doing a picture called Embryo with Rock Hudson. It's a small movie. And so I was doing that, and then Steven came to me, and he said, you know, we got a deal at Columbia. So I met the head of production of Columbia Studios, John Veitch. And he said, Joe, this is a very small, low-budget sci-fi movie. Everything's going to be done on the back lot or on the soundstage here. But you need one strange-looking mountain. So nobody else was on the film. So I location scout or anything. So I got in the car, and I had researched various parks in Shiprock, Chimney Rock, Monument Valley, all these different rocks and things, and I drove for 3,000 miles with my camera and shot all these things, and then I found Devil's Tower, and it just blew me away, the shape of Devil's Tower and all that. So I came back. In those days, you know, you shot 35mm film, and then you paste them together on a big illustration board, and I presented it to Steve, and he said, without question, it's Devil's Tower. So as we got back to the studio, and John Veitch said, so you're going to build your set. I made a model of this arena where the mothership comes down. And he says, you could have stage 16 and 15. They're connected. I think they shot Camelot there. And I said to him, well, it looks a little small. He said, what? This is the biggest set on the lot. And they shot Camelot, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I said, okay, so I made a model for that size of the stage because I wanted this to be a big arena. This is an important thing. We're having a spaceship come down and land, and they wanted to be prepared with all this, you know, equipment to photograph it and to measure it and all that. Anyway, so I made a model for that size, and but the studio had some problems. They really needed a big movie. Now, Jaws is becoming a big success. Well, with that success, Steven enlarged the script and the concept, and I felt more comfortable enlarging my set. And there's nothing like success to give you the confidence, and the studio thinking, oh, these guys just made this big movie, made millions. We need, you know, them to do that for us. So basically, they came and they looked at the model, had all these executives, and they said, Julia and Michael Phillips were the producers, and they said, so what do you think? And I said, I think it's too small. And they said, well, what do you think, how big it should be? I said, four times this. So I made a model four times that size, And they said, oh, this looks great, you know, because people are really small and little, you know, golf carts running around. So it was gigantic. And they said, well, where are you going to build it? So being the smart ass that I was, I had no idea. I just thought, oh, I'll make this big. And it had to be inside because we needed to have control the light. And Doug Trumbull was going to do the effect. So everything had to be inside. So I started looking for hangars, World War II Zeppelin hangars and stuff, and I did find a couple.
No, that wasn't a real mountain that you guys used?
I mean, where Dreyfus walks up and they look down?
Yeah, well, the whole... Oh, God, I'm stupid.
But no, let me say this. Okay.
The whole landing strip and everything was actually on top of a mountain. Oh, my God.
No, it was in a huge hangar. I found this big hangar in Mobile, Alabama, and I could extend it another 150 feet. So that whole landing area was 300 feet wide and 450 feet long, a football field wide and a football field and a half long. That was just the arena. Now, where they climb up and they look down on the arena, that was a mountain that we made in the stage. It was 7 stories on roller, so they could climb up there. The long shots of Devil's Tower, we shot at Devil's Tower.
And where is that located? I'm sorry, pardon me.
It's Wyoming.
Wyoming.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's a feature part of their park division. They sent me up there. They asked me to come up a couple years ago, and they did a promotional video of me doing exactly the same thing, scouting it, that I did 40 years earlier. And they wanted to... advertise their parks, their Yellowstone and Devil's Tower and Monument Valley and all that stuff.
Did you have a role in Close Encounters?
No.
Oh, because one of the pictures I saw of you, it looks like the guy who, the Frenchman, I believe he's speaking French.
Oh, Francois Truffaut?
Yeah. I. You look like him in a picture.
He was a very cool guy. I was surprised Stephen got him because he's a pretty successful director. And I said, Stephen, why would he want to do this? And anyway, he wanted to, and so he was an interesting guy. He spoke English sometimes. You never knew if he was he could understand, you know, spoke it or not. I mean, it was strange, but anyway.
Yeah. Dean, do you have anything else for Joe? Or
who's that, me?
Yes. For Joe?
No, I just think it's all kind of fascinating. I love hearing production, designer stories and things like that, and going behind the scenes and hearing about it all.
Go buy my book, and you'll see all the details.
Well, have Joanne put the details of your book online. What is the book?
The book is on Amazon. It's called Joe Alves Designing Jaws, and you could get it on Amazon.
I'll definitely get it.
And it's the reason I liked it so much because the writer, Dennis Prince, I met him on one of these fan shows, and Greg Nicotero, who does The Walking Dead, he did the foreword because he's a big Jaws fan. But basically, it's not me so much as the whole structure of how things were done. And most books are written about directors or actors, and this is about, you know, the designer, the decorator, the effects people, the people behind the camera. Right?
Yeah. Right. Well, Joe,
keep on making it all happen.
But Regina was just up for an Oscar for the Irishman. She was a set designer on that.
Oh,
wonderful.
Decorator.
Well,
decorator.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Let me say, it's interesting because when I did Jaws, it was such a low-budget picture. I took a painter and a carpenter, and that was it. And I used all local people. John Dwyer took his best man, and pretty much we used local talents. So
well, where
it was
John from? Was he local?
Who? John Dwyer? No. John did many, many films after it. He did a number of the Star Trek things and stuff like that. No, he'd been around. He just passed away last year. He was a nice guy.
Was he from L.A. area?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He
was a studio guy. He was like I was. We were staff guys, you know. In the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, it broke up in the 60s. You bounced around. If you were a set designer or an actor, you worked until there was no films at MGM, then you'd go to Warner Bros. Or Warner Brothers or Fox or Paramount. I got kicked around as a set designer until I became a senior, and then I landed at Universal, and I did It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World. I was on that for... And then I became... an assistant, and I worked with Hitchcock, and I did the Elvis Presley movie, Change of Habit, his last movie. Oh, and you wanted to ask about Elvis.
I wanted to ask you, what did your job entail on that movie? There was no special...
I was assistant art director, so I made the sets. I designed the sets with the art director, and... followed through on that, you know. It and Elvis would come in with his entourage, and you know. So you didn't really. Actually, he would be late quite often, and Mary Tyler Moore was the actress, and she would be pretty upset with him because he would be late, and he wouldn't know his lines.
Yeah.
You know.
Aww.
And so he was. That was his last movie. So
I think he was done with the acting by then. I think he was done with the acting by then. He was looking for a more serious role, and you know, it didn't take off. And you know, but but no, that's one of my favorite Elvis movies, actually. And I did hear that the two of them had a little so.
She was really, you know, on time, on there, hit the mark, blah blah blah.
She was a professional.
And he was just a big star, and so he was. I worked for something. Steven Seagal was like that too. He would show up late, know. But anyway.
What was your last movie?
Oh, I'm sorry.
What was your last movie that you did before you retired or? Left the business.
It's interesting. I did two animated movies, which I designed, because I used to be an animator too. For an Indian company called Sinbad Beyond the Veil, and that used a lot of the new techniques, CGI kind of stuff, where we would put people in. Decorate, put lights on them, and then we would animate that. And I did like four trips to India, and then I did another thing called Pizza and the Web, and I worked on it for 2 years. It was half animation, half live action, and it was ran out of money, and it never got released. And so that sort of was a sad ending. And then I was caught between. After Jaws 3, I had a lot of deals. I was as a director, and I worked on one project called can't remember now. Adventure One, and I worked on it for 7 months, and then the money ran out, and so that did happen. So it became a lot of projects that didn't happen. I worked on. A number of things that, you know, anyway, it was a changing time in the studio. They were being bought and sold and stuff. I scouted one movie I was going to direct on Formula One racing, and I scouted all the tracks in Europe and Monte Carlo and all that, and I got back. But to do it was sold to somebody else, and they canceled everything. So that's sort of the way it goes sometimes in this.
Hollywood. Definitely.
Wow. Well, Gina, thank you so much for calling. I mean, are you have anything else for Joe?
No, I'm going to go out and get his book, definitely.
Yes, well, I'm going to.
Oh, Dina, we're good. I'm glad you would. And as I say, I've had some great decorators, and Phil Abramson was my decorator on Close Encounters, and he was just amazing. And he passed away. They're all all the people have gone, you know, that I've worked with.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrible.
Well, anyway, go ahead, Joe. I'm sorry.
Have a good future, good career run.
Thank you.
Oh, nice. How nice.
Thank
is
you.
That?
Thank you, Regina.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to get it. Thank you.
If I'm not correct, don't hang up, Gene. I think I just saw on Facebook it's your birthday today.
No, it's not my birthday. April's my birthday.
I saw Regina's birthday on there. Oh, I got somebody else. I'm on my I told them when I got on, I don't know what day it is anymore. I'm losing my mind. Oh, my God.
I know. Well, every day just runs into the other.
I know. Well, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it. Love you. And thanks for talking to Joe. And you guys had a fantastic conversation. I loved it. Thank you.
Yeah, I loved it. All right. Thank you,
okay.
Joe. Take care.
Bye. I could have twice saw her birthday.
I got a question for Joe. Joanne.
Yeah, Johnny boy. Yeah.
Hey, Joe. What's your honest opinion about the CGI effects in all the movies these days? Because I'm old school. I like the old effects where it was done in the studio.
Well, okay. I think it's getting better. Here's what bothered me at first is I use this as an example. Let's say John Wayne and the Cavalry come out and there's maybe 24 cavalry, and then over the mountain comes the Indians, and there'd be maybe 75, 100 Indians, right? And you say, oh, okay, my God, they're going to have to fight. Well, in recent years, they'll put 300,000 because they could use, they just multiply. And even, some of the newer Star Wars, they had so many creatures, it was just, come on, it's over the top. In other words, they put a lot because they could do it, and it doesn't cost much. They just multiply it. And the other thing is they don't do everything so much in green screen. Like I was saying in Close Encounters, we had Belinda and Dreyfus. They had to climb up this seven-story mountain, but it was like real. And then we had a big front projection screen, and then Trumbull shots at, and then we put the big, arena behind. Today, it would all be green screen.
Right.
And when Steven said he hadn't worked on a set this big ever, is because they don't build them.
They don't need them. They don't need them because they're doing the CGI, I guess.
George Lucas came to our set on Close Encounters, and he flipped out. He said, my gosh, in Star Wars, we didn't have anything. We just built the same set, and we just kept repainting it and running around the corner. And that was interesting because that picture beat me for the Academy Awards, Star Wars. But I won the British Academy Award against the British that designed Star Wars, so it was sort of interesting. But, CGI is good if you – if you just go back to good filmmaking, and yes, it would be nice if they had a shark that you could do the whole swimming, the whole thing in CGI, but it would be nice when you have a contact, a relationship between the actor and the object, that part of it was real. Do you know?
Nice.
Right now,
yes.
You don't know, they don't know what they're grabbing.
You can't interact with what you're doing.
Exactly.
Direction.
Yep.
Right. Yeah, less people to hire. It's taking people out of work, too. I mean, it makes it look better to some degree, but, you're taking away
it's just amazing what you can do. There's no question about it.
Right.
But it's such a different world because so much is done on the computer. When I gave my speech for the Art Directors Guild and I was telling the art directors about 1,000 of them, I said, when I was scouting for the mountain in Close Encounters, I was driving 3,000 miles. I said, but today you guys would just Google it. You didn't have to drive. You just
right.
Google
right.
all these mountains. I said, but you
right.
miss all the scenery along the way, you know. I mean,
yeah,
it's just a different world.
Yeah.
It's such a different world where we go out scouting to look for something. Now you could get on, you know, the world map and, that looks like a good mountain. Yeah.
Right. Wow.
So it's different, guys, you know. And
I know you're retired, Joe, but do you dabble in anything? Or do you,
dabble?
What are you doing?
I sculpt. I must have 65 sculptures. I'm looking
wow.
right now out my window, and I have a 5-foot mermaid that's all wood. And then I have under her is we've got octopus and a huge squid, and then I've got a couple little sharks, and then I've got some other figures, and I've done about 10 mermaids, different sizes, some in clay, some in wood, because I don't know, I got the thing with sharks and mermaids, and so it's like the softer jaws, you know, mermaids.
Mm.
So I sculpt constantly, is one of my favorite things. And I also, you know, been very busy with the jaws thing, signing pictures and doing drawings. I just did a thing where I did 25 shark drawings for some guy, you know, and I sold them. So, yeah, I've been very busy.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So, John, I don't know if you have any more questions for Joe, but I was going to
I do have a question. Joe, you worked with Alfred Hitchcock. He was a master at suspense, mm-hmm. and he didn't really show a lot of the violence that, you know, it was all, we pitched it in our minds. What do you think of today's movies where they're so graphic and the people don't think anymore? What's your feeling about that?
Oh, you know, this is an interesting point because I want to bring something back to Jaws, really, relative to Hitchcock. When we used the barrels, those red, yellow barrels, and people said we used them because the shark wasn't working. Nonsense. It was a real Hitchcock thing. Stephen wanted. The barrel pops up, and you go, oh, my God, the shark's down there because it's attached to that. And then two barrels pop up. And then, you know, he can't go down with two barrels, and he goes down. And you say, oh, my God, this guy's got to be big. So there's the suspense there.
Right.
And that's what Hitchcock would do. And I think today they're so terribly graphic. I mean, you used to have to wait. The door creeps open. What's going to happen, you know?
That's right.
And there are good movies and there are good directors that do keep it a little bit more suspenseful. But
yeah,
I
didn't think Jaws was all gory. It was left up to your imagination what was happening to that person that was being attacked. You know, it wasn't full of gore. You know, it was your suspense and your imagination to see what the outcome was. Obviously, they're going to die, but there wasn't that much blood and gore in there, right?
I mean, the first girl that gets it, she's tied to a rope. We have three guys on each side, and she's being pulled. And she goes under, and there was no shark, no blood. She was gone.
Right.
And then you see later a piece of a hand or something.
Yeah,
and then it wasn't, you know, until we got to the Quint's desk or death where, you know, he chews him up. So, no, Stephen was very good to hold the suspense.
Yeah,
and that's why I think the movie lives. When I did Jaws 2, the studio was involved. And they wanted more shark. And I shot so much shark. And then the editor, Verna Fields, was a producer there. She won the Academy Award for editing Jaws. Then we slowly cut it back out as much because they thought more shark is going to be greater for the audience. Well, not necessarily, you know. So you have to let them wait for it, you know,
right.
I feel. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, John, anything else you want to add to, or any questions for Joe?
Well, I think Joe is right. There's so many horror movies today that, you know, the blood squirting everywhere that you don't even remember what the hell they are. And like Jaws, something like that, or Psycho, I mean, those pictures, you could watch them, you know, 30, 50, 60 years later on, and they still scare the hell out of you.
Yeah, it's very important.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's why Jaws lives, because you did have to wait and wait. And, you know, the guy's out there and the dock is turning around. Oh, my God, the shark has got the dock. You know, he's going to get the guy, and then he disappears.
Well, I've never let my kids see the movie because they love the ocean too much. So I would never show them that movie.
Yeah, you're probably right. Is that it? Are we...
Yeah, so I just wanted to say, where can folks find you if they wanted to reach out to you? Have a website for anybody?
JoeAlvesMovieArt.com.
Cool.
And on that, there's various things that I have for sale, storyboards, illustrations, things like that. So I'd say JoeAlvesMovieArt.com is how I could be contacted and stuff. JoeAlvesMovieArt.com.
Mm-hmm. And we also have the book, Joe Alves, Design the Book, on Amazon.
Go ahead, honey. And I'm very, very pleased with the book. I think it's done well. So I guess that's it.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. It was an absolute pleasure.
Okay.
And
thank
I can't
you,
thank
Joey.
You enough for your patience and your
my
kindness.
Pleasure.
And your kindness
okay,
for coming back. Thank you, Joe Alves.
All
right. A pleasure. You have a good evening, sir.
You too.
Take care, Joe. Bye-bye.
Oh, what a nice guy. Wow. Oh, my God. You can't believe all the stuff he's worked on. It's amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah, I thought you would have more questions for him.
People today don't understand what was involved in doing stuff back then, which you had to actually make the creatures. You know, nowadays you just put it into the computer and it's there, you know, and it looks like a video game to me. It doesn't look good. So like I was telling Joe, I'd rather have the old school, mechanical things and suspense where you don't see the monster all the time. You don't see the monster's teeth or the blood all over the place. You leave it up to your imagination. Joanne?
Yeah.
Oh, there you are. Okay, I thought we lost you there for a second. Yeah, but there's no imagination anymore. People just don't have an imagination, and you know they have to be shown everything. And if you don't show it, the movie doesn't sell, which is very sad.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
I don't know what's going on.
Right. Well, let's give Shirley King a call and get her on the line. So get her on the show and play her songs because it's getting late for her. And so let's give her a shout. You're probably going to lose me for a second, okay? Hang on.
Okay, we'll lose Joanne. But
you know, I got nothing.
Well, you're out there get the information for who's coming up next week on the show too.
Hopefully we'll get
Shirley King on there.
Yeah.
And in fact, I seen her father play a couple of years ago in Pennsylvania, and he was just fantastic. I always, he's one of my guitar heroes, BB King. You know. He was always the one who never played like super fast or super elaborate, and it was always, you know, he played the right note at the right time, and he knew how to play it, and that's what made him such a great guitar player. He didn't show off. It came from the heart with B.B. King, and just you listen to anything, even his singing, it's from the heart. Do you have Shirley on the line?
Yes, we have the amazing Shirley King on the phone with us, and she is known as the daughter of the blues because of her dad, who is B.B. King, and Shirley is not just B.B. King's daughter. She is a singer in her own right. Shirley, thank you so much. Welcome to the show. I can't thank you enough for joining us. How are you today?
I am so blessed. I'm blessed. I'm John is working me to death. I'm going to be too tired to sing when he gets through with me.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, God. Can't do that. Can't do that.
Okay, but thank God I don't have to work until a little later on in the year because I have did so many interviews. I am so, like, shocked to see people talking to me about this CD, and it was all the brainstorm of Cleopatra Records and John. They they did this without my help. All they had to do is sing a few songs.
Nice. Well, I'll tell you, we can't thank you enough for letting us play your songs tonight since the release is on the 19th. It's amazing. I thank you so much. But before we play them, why don't we get into it was funny when John, our co-host here on the show, John Arricchio, when I told him you were going to be on the show, he said, oh, is her name Lucille? I was like, why didn't your dad name you Lucille?
Oh, my dad didn't name no kids Lucille. And guess what? None of the kids' mother was named Lucille. 15 mothers and nobody was named Lucille.
Oh, my goodness. So where did he get the name Lucille?
The Lucille came from the night he was playing and the place caught on fire and he ran out and left his guitar in there and he ran back in there to try to get it because he didn't have another one and almost lost his life in a fire trying to save a guitar.
Oh, my.
He said he found out two men that knocked the stove over that was fighting and knocked the stove over fighting over a woman named Lucille.
Oh.
He decided to name the guitar Lucille to remind him to never do nothing that stupid again.
That's a great story. Oh, my God. So you must have grown up, I mean, your dad was just the king of blues and... Why did you wait so long to want to get involved in music?
Well, actually, I didn't wait a long time. I actually was singing, you know.
No, I mean, releasing music. I know you were in the choir and everything. I mean, as a professional singer, you know.
No, that's what I'm telling you now. I was singing, but I wasn't singing blues because I hated blues because I thought blues took my dad away from me. No one would have ever in their lifetime figured Shirley King would sing the blues. You know, if I was going to do any singing, it probably would have been R&B or gospel album.
Yeah.
But what happened is that I came here to Chicago. And what do you have here in Chicago?
Blues.
Nothing but blues, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't be an R&B singer because you have to have a hit record out all the time. And everybody knew who my dad was, so... Billy Branch, one of the blues musicians that started hanging around, he goes, like, you got to be crazy. Your dad is the king of blues, and you don't want to sing blues. Girl, get up here on this mic and sing. Mm. So he would have me to come to all his shows and get up and sing, got my mojo working.
Uh-huh. And I got my mojo working.
Definitely
on you.
That's right. All right. I started singing that, and then... he had teamed me up with Shirley Dixon, which was Willie Dixon's daughter.
Mm.
And she loved doing Let the Good Time Roll. So we started calling ourselves the Blues Sisters because she would sing my daddy's song and I would sing her daddy's song.
Oh, cool.
So it started being a lot of fun. It started being fun. So I said, oh, I can do this. This is a lot of fun. So
yeah.
I went to the Kingston Mine, the top club here in Chicago, where everybody wants to work. I went there and had a girlfriend singing there, and I asked her, could I get up and jam? And she wouldn't let me jam. One night she got sick or tired. I don't know what it was. But anyway, she gave me the mic, and I ran up on stage. I was so happy to run up on stage. I forgot I didn't know the words to the song. I got up on stage, and I looked out in the audience, and the place was standing room jam-packed. I mean, it was something, I couldn't even see the flow. And I'm up there looking at everybody like, I forgot. So I just kept on saying, got my mojo working. After a while, I said, hey, I know what I can do. I just started shaking my hips and dancing. I went to doing a whole complete act with the mojo. And then I saw the owner, and I wanted to impress him because I was trying to get a job. I wanted to impress him. So when I went to shaking, I ran and sit in his lap and just turn the place out. standing ovation.
Nice, wow. Well, I know your dad was an influence on you musically too, but was Etta James, was she one of your big role models, or Mahalia?
She was the major reason. You know why? Because when I would go and see my dad back in the older days, he didn't work with too many blues artists. I'd never really seen blues people till I came to Chicago. They would always have my father on stage with people like Jane Brown, Jackie Wilson, Sam Cooke. He was working with all the R&B singers because he always had a big band and a big sound. He didn't have a traditional blues or just a blues sound. So I would always see him and all these guys. And one time I went to his show. My auntie took me to see him because that's how I had to see him. I had to go to the show, hang out on the stage, watch him perform. He run by and kiss me and hug me and tell me how much he loved me and give me some money and get going. I mean, I lived like that for almost 10 years of seeing my daddy saying hi and bye. I should be making a song called Hi and Bye because that's all I could do. He was so busy trying to make a name for himself, and it took care of me. And he had me staying with his family, so he always made sure I was taken care of. And that's how he had to do it. But Etta James one night came out on the stage on one of the shows, and I'm looking like, oh, my God. Because, being young like that, I didn't know women supposed to be on the stage singing with men.
Yeah.
And she walked on that stage, and that's during the time when women was wearing them fishtail dresses. And if they were built all up, they looked like something from a movie. She looked like a black Marilyn Monroe. A doll or something. When I looked and saw that, I said, ooh, wait, I want to be like her. And then when I grew up and came to Chicago, I started meeting all kind of blues women. So she was the first one I saw. That's why she was such an idol to me. And I never stopped wanting to be like that. And when I finally got in the business and started doing shows, she was not a people person. So she would never take my hand and say hi to me. I told my dad, I was like, Daddy, you famous like Etta James, and she always on your shows and everything. Can you get her to give me an autograph? My dad said, baby, listen to this. Etta James is on most of my shows, and she don't even speak to me. he said that used to be my girlfriend. I said, what? I said, why you didn't marry her so she could be my stepmother? He said, well, she don't even speak to me, so I can't help you with that. Guess who helped me get a chance to speak one time to Etta James? My one only son. He went out on the road with my daddy, and Etta James was infatuated with him and started liking him, and he had her to call me on my birthday. I almost fainted. And she would come out, I'm your biggest fan. And I'm like, Miss James, I know you're lying, but just lie to me. I don't care what you say. You can say anything you want to say. I was so glad to just get a chance to speak to her before she left this earth.
Nice. That's nice. Oh, that's beautiful. My God. So let me add, this album, Blues for a King. So how did you pick the songs that you picked, and how did you get all these amazing artists want to join you? I mean, I shouldn't say how. I mean, anybody would come banging on your door to work with you. But what was their interest so much? What was their interest behind the album?
No, that is not what it was. These people don't even know me. I've never met any of these guitar players. Not one.
Really? Not even Joe Louis Walker? Not even
Joe Louis Walker. The reason I know Joe Louis Walker, because when my father died, all my daddy's amazing, famous friends didn't even give me a second thought. They didn't look at me. They didn't ask me to come hang out and sit on the stage to watch their show. Joe Louis Walker was the only person that reached out to me and asked me how I was doing. He tried to connect me with his manager, and that didn't really work. He's the only one that called me when my daddy passed on. The only one.
No.
So for him to end back up on the CD with me, I'm just amazing. It just goes to show you what's for you is for you, and who's to be with you will be
right.
With you.
Well, now, you know what? Joe's gonna be on our show in July. Joe's joining us in July.
Yeah, I know, because John is doing both me and him. So he either got us both on the same day or either the day after or whatever.
He's working you guys hard, huh?
Right. John is booking the artist for Cleopatra Records. So he mainly doing a lot of booking for me and Joe. But Joe is a really nice guy, but I've never met him. And he was supposed to be playing here in Chicago in August or September of last year. And when all this started happening, his show got canceled.
Yeah.
That would have been my first time of meeting Joe Louis Walker. And the rest of these guys I never met before in my life.
Wow.
John Lefton put these guitar players on my CD because he knew them.
You got Elvin Bishop, Harvey Mandel, Junior Wells, Duke Robillard, Joe Louis Walker, I mean, Kirk Fletcher, Pat Travers. I mean, amazing.
And you know what? As I sit back and think, I'm thinking, because I've never needed a CD when my dad was living. I never had to have a CD to work. People would see me one time, and after that, I was in. I was in like this. But what happened, when I was out there working a lot, I was the opening act for Duke Rowland, but I just thought about that when you call that name. I did a lot of stuff up in Massachusetts, and I would be the opening act. But, you know, you don't get a chance to meet the headliner sometimes because they don't want you, you know, bothering them. But I was on the show with him, but I didn't get a chance to meet him. So not none of these guitar players have I ever met. We didn't do this in the studio together. They sent a track here. They had me to sing the track. They took it back to California. They went and gave the guitar their parts, and they played their parts from somewhere else. And then it got to Cleopatra. That's how that all happened.
Wow.
I have met nobody. I didn't get a chance to hear the song until it came out.
Wow. And some great songs, too. Oh, my God. All of My Loving, That's All Right, Mama, Can't Find My Way Home, Feeling Good. Oh, my God. Give It Up. Gallows Pole. That's a great one. Hoodoo Man. It's just unbelievable. Unbelievable. Well, if you don't mind, can we play? I picked Gallows Pole and Can't Find My Way Home. Is that okay if we play those for you?
Yes.
Gallows Pole, I want everybody to give a listen to, because this is the Gallows Pole that Led Zeppelin has sang as well. And I don't think a lot of people know that a lot of their Led Zeppelin songs were blues songs that they turned into rock. So which one you want to hear first, Shirley, Gallows Pole or Can't Find My Way Home?
It doesn't matter. Either one, whatever your choice is.
All right, well, we'll do maybe half of them, John. What do you think?
Yeah, we do half of each one. We'll start with Gallows Pole.
Yeah, okay. Here's Gallows Pole by Shirley Gaines.
Friend, did you get some silver? Did
Nice.
That's amazing,
nice.
Shirley. Amazing.
Yes, very nice, Shirley. Oh, man.
Hey, Shirley, I got a question for Shirley, I got a question for you. Do you play these songs live with the live band? Have you been out on the road with these songs?
No, that was just this CD was just done.
It's not with you.
It hasn't been been released. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But when you plan on going out? Well, you know, if the pandemic go away, you know, can't none of us do. So Louis Walker too all the time, and John was just telling me he don't know when he's going to have a date because, you know, they're not allowing live entertainment at too many places now.
Right.
That's right.
Well, got to wait hopefully soon. So that was Gallows Pole. I loved it. I don't know if you guys heard the Zeppelin in there, the lyrics at least, but that's where that song came from, you guys who are listening to Gallows Pole by Led Zeppelin. And the next one is Can't Find My Way Home. John, you want to play Can't Find My Way Home?
But let me tell you what's going to happen. When I come out and do these songs live, I'm going to be done had the feeling. Because what happened, I only had like 3 weeks to maybe 4 weeks to learn all these songs and to sing them. I didn't have no time of working with them. They were brand new to me. And they were all men's songs. That was kind of like a rush job because as I listened to it and I'm singing it now, I got a better feel because now I know the song a little bit.
Yeah, but I felt like Can't Find My Way Home, you had more feel to that one. You were more into that one when you sang it. Like it meant more to you, I think. I don't know. To me, I felt it more.
Well, I even feel I could do much better on live stage.
Oh, yeah.
Now that song took a deep part of my heart, because I started thinking about my dad and, you know, trying to live in this world without him after having him so long. I'm constantly up and down on my feeling. You know, I haven't had a chance to grieve because I've been laughing to keep from crying.
Yeah, so, well, Cheryl, I felt it. I felt it in the song. I did. I felt the feeling in that one.
Hey, Shirley.
I definitely did.
Shirley.
Thank
you. Do you think you'd ever do some of your dad's songs?
Well, what happened is that they were supposed to endear me with my daddy. The thrill is gone. But the state is still fighting over my daddy's stuff and all kind of craziness going on. So I think that's why they backed off of the B.B. King Thrill Is Gone with me. Because they had said they was going to do that, and they went and got Junior Well and did brought him back from the grave and did Us Together.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen on the stage? My dad was on the stage one night here in Chicago at the Tinley Park. And he was performing, him and Aaron Neville. It was about four acts. Mm. And he brought me on stage to jam with him on Rock Me Baby. And I was able to get hold to that tape and have him. He was calling me on stage. He was looking for me because he would call me on, and sometimes I'd be lost and had to find my way back home. But anyway, he called me on stage, and he was like, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is my daughter, Shirley King. She lives here in Chicago. Shirley, come on." And I'm like, "Everybody, come on, your daddy calling you. Come on, hurry up." And I'm running through Tinley Park trying to get to the stage. Because I didn't want, and by the time I was coming up there, I heard him say, Charlie Ann, your daddy wants you." And I ran out there, and they was able to take that off of that little taping that was done and put it on my music video. So now I have a video singing about being a daughter of the blues with my daddy calling me on stage. And every night when I close the show out, I'm going to do Feeling All Right to make the crowd go crazy. Nice. Then I'm going to calm them down with The Thrill Is Gone, Shirley King Way, but a big old screen going to drop down. This is what I told the record company I want. A big screen going to drop down with my daddy from the YouTube playing Thrill Is Gone, and we're going to sing it together.
Nice. Well, you also, I want to know, what did you do when you were involved with the artist-in-residence program with the Urban Gateways? Are you still involved with that? And what did you do with those guys, with the kids?
Well, I had to leave that program because what had happened, they had about 40 artists doing different types of things, and the demand for me to show up for performance got so demanding until they would say, "Well, we got other artists. Well, you going to stop me from working? Because if they are hiring me, I mean, you know, I'm sorry your other artists are not in demand." But that kind of, you know, broke us up. So what happened, the kids loved me everywhere I went. So some people went to hire me without the Urban Gateway program. What happened is that a young lady that was moving around with me, she saw how well I was doing the program, and she created a Shirley King own program, a book about 70 pages long. It talks from the beginning to the end. It tells the kids how to come in and be an audience. It prepares them for the show. It tells them how to be it. And then it only talks about two artists, Shirley King and Booker White. And you might say, "Well, why Booker White?" Because Booker White was B.B. King's cousin. So you got traditional blues that I use that because I'm here in Chicago. And that's what used to always drive the kids crazy. I would do it, but I was full of energy. I didn't go in and do no lump-de-lump blues because the kids wouldn't have came to the assembly. I made them have so much of fun till the group that came in first tried to sneak back in with the second group. And the school was just blown away. Because they couldn't get kids to come to the blues assembly. And when I started doing it, I mean, I was in big demand. So I'm going to bring that back. And when I start touring, what I'm going to do, I'm going to select a school at every place I go and give them a 30 to 45-minute performance on my expense.
That's really nice.
Yeah, that's nice. Well,
I did a lot of blues up in Boston, though. I was involved with a school. I can't think of the name of it right now, but they had a very strong program where they would bring artists in to help support students through the year, right? And then I was working with, I really started getting a lot of TV action with Daniel Banks. I met him when he was 13 years old and started doing shows with him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, Shirley, thank you so much for joining us. We're running long. We're running over time. We've got like 5 minutes left. But, ladies and gentlemen, Miss Shirley King, her new CD will be released on Friday, June 19th. It's called Blues for a King. Well, you've heard two great songs from it. There are even more. She actually has At Last on there, too. I should have picked that one. I didn't have that one, so I would have loved to have played At Last for you. But I loved it. I loved it, loved it, loved it. And I wish you nothing but the best, and I can't wait to see you sing someday live and hear you really belt these suckers out.
Yeah, well, I'm waiting for that, too, because now that I'm being accepted from doing it, you know, I'm going to make sure that when I do it, I'm going to leave everybody talking.
And I don't doubt it. Believe me, you will. You will.
And you know, a week after I released my CD on the 19th, Juneteenth, my dad, somebody went and got it and brought it back with a remix of B.B. King and Eric Clapton song coming out that next week.
Right. Well, you can also get Shirley on YouTube. You can catch her out there. And, you do Big Boss Man, too?
Huh?
Oh, I love that song, Big Boss Man. Big Boss Man.
Well, you know, when I'm doing shows, I do all of that because I'm here in Chicago, so I hear all of that all the time.
Yeah, great stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Great stuff. Oh, real quick before you go, have you ever played at the B.B. King's Blues in New York?
You know what? I didn't even get a chance. I went there a lot of times with my dad, but I never got a chance to play there
I think you need to.
No, there's no more. They shut down right after he died. They shut it down.
No, really? I thought it was still open.
No, they closed it down, and I think they let Buddy Guy close it out, and they didn't even offer Shirley King a come sit in the seat thing because nobody wants to live my dad's legacy. Nobody wants me to perform after my dad, but everybody else want to be able to perform, you know.
Yeah. Wow. I haven't been to New York in maybe about 2 years. I could swear I saw it. It may not be open, but it's there.
No, they closed that club down almost, I think, about 7 months after my dad passed. Because first of all, the family was fighting, and they was coming out, B.B. King. You know, it was really bad. So they didn't want to have their name tied up with that. But the B.B. King Club in Memphis and the other ones are still open because they weren't ran together. One man owned the other B.B. King Club, and that was ran by the business people in New York.
Okay, but the other ones are still open. But
yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, Shirley. Ladies and gentlemen, Shirley King, look for her new CD, and you'll check out some great stuff on there. And she is known as Daughter of the Blues, and new CD is Blues for a King, and it's coming out Friday, June 19th. Look for it on Amazon and any other social access. You can find music, Spotify, everything. It's there. It's going to be there. So, Shirley, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Shirley.
I love the music. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay.
And you take care. And
thank you, Shirley.
You stay safe.
All the best with the new album. Take care.
Yes.
Okay, then. Thank you very much, and God bless both of y'all.
Thank you, honey. You too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye,
take
sweetie.
Take care. Bye. Oh, wow. How cool was that, huh? Talking to B.B. King's daughter, man. It's just, oh, man. I don't know how it sounds to you guys out there, but, I mean, it was fabulous. I definitely felt the feeling Can't Find My Way more than I did in Gallo Hall, but, you know, but, all right, so,
Only other version I know is the Yardbirds, I think, did the original one, I think, Can't Find My Way
what,
Back
Gallo's
Home,
Hall?
I know of. No, I Can't Find My Way Back Home, the Yardbirds, I think, did it.
Yeah, maybe it was.
Right,
yeah,
well, we're
going to
end, Joanne, so we'll say goodnight to everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening. On Sunday, we have a special show. We've got a show with the president of the Emmy Awards. We're going to do an announcement for the Daytime Emmy Awards. And then on Wednesday, Bruce Valanche and Maggie Jones. So thank you to our listeners, our callers. Thank you to our sponsors. We've got the Hyde Bar and Bistro in Garfield, New Jersey, Precious Memory Video in Kitnersville, Pennsylvania, KWVY in South Africa, Tees for the Times, Clifton, New Jersey, Syntec Productions in Lenoka Harbor, and Oleander PR in Texas, and TakeABreakFromCancer.org. Check out their site and see if you can help them out, where they're helping people out who have cancer, and it's for Pete's sake. Thank you all. Take care. Have a good night. Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody.
Bye, Johnny boy.
Bye-bye.